My name is Chris Mackey, and I'm on the teaching team here at ECV. And I just want to share for a few minutes of what God may be wanting to say to us as a group from His Word today. We're going through a series the last few weeks on leadership, and so we're just thinking about what that means for us in our lives when it comes to God and us and other people in our lives. And so we're gonna talk a little bit about mentoring today, but I want to say just a couple things. Usually, you know, every couple times I share, I want to make sure I get my picture of my kids up on the screen, because, you know, if you're a parent, you know why. I show them off. But Matt and Hannah, as you just heard, just had their first child. And parents know, and Matt and Hannah will soon find out, that parenting is both thrilling and terrifying. It's thrilling because of the prospect of being able to shape a human life is pretty thrilling. Not completely. You know, there are certainly other circumstances and other forces in life that help shape kids' lives, but the prospect of having such influence to be able to shape another human life is pretty thrilling. But it's also pretty terrifying because, you know, you're shaping another human life. And that's pretty terrifying to feel that responsibility. It's thrilling when you think of all of the good stuff that you want to pass on to people, to your kids in particular. You know, it's thrilling when you see your kids, for example, using language to express gratitude. You know, using language to build people up. It's terrifying when you hear your child use language that doesn't build people up and it sounds eerily familiar to you and what you might have said recently in the recent past. Not that that ever happens with us, but, you know, just hypothetically. You know, it's thrilling to see your kids, you know, thinking about other people, being generous, you know, wanting to. Our daughter at one point a few weeks ago thought, hey, let's make crafts for all the people in the neighborhood and deliver them to all the people in the neighborhood, because her mom at Easter took her around to the immediate neighbors, and they had made baskets, and they took them to the neighbors, and she loved that. And so it's cool to kind of sew that into another person's life, a life of others. But it's also, you know, on the other side of that is to see when there's no sharing and there's no generosity anywhere. What's mine is mine. You may not have it. It's a little terrifying to realize that they might have picked that up somewhere. You know, your stuff is your stuff and don't want to share it. So it's thrilling and terrifying. Now, the question is, why don't kids and humans, you know, adults in general, why don't kids just learn the good stuff? You know? Like, we tell them the good stuff. We tell them all this stuff that we've learned and stuff that would be valuable to them and helpful to them in their lives. And, you know, just do what I say. Just, then you'll be okay. Why don't they just learn the good stuff? And the answer is obvious, isn't it? Because they're watching you, right? They're observing. And so here's my thought. Is we humans have been designed to catch life, right? They say lessons are more caught than taught. And so we have been designed from very young to catch life by observing other people. Think about your life, where you are, what you believe, what you're doing in life, and you can kind of point to a handful of people probably that sort of rise to the top of lives that you've watched. You know, usually from very close up, people who have invited you into their lives and have taught you lessons and shared wisdom with you or helped you through a particular point in your life, and those people sort of sowed things into you or shared life with you, and you caught that, and it became part of your life. That's really how we how we learn life. And so what I'm saying is, this is how it works. This is mentoring. We are mentored. We are shaped by the lives of others. We are mentored. If you think of mentoring as sort of leading someone on down through a path and sharing your life with them so that they can learn lessons as they go through life, we are mentored. And the other side of that coin is we mentor people. We do. People watch our lives. Kids in particular, if you're a parent, but people watch your life. Students, peers. And so it's critical that we ask these two questions, and I think it's I am pressing the button, by the way. Maybe we won't ask those two questions. It's this slide right here. I don't know if that matters. Okay, I'll just ask them. You don't have to read them. Two questions. One is, if this is inevitable, if this we catch life and people catch life from us, the questions are, whose life am I catching? Whose life am I catching? And what kind of life are people catching from me? It's essential that we ask those questions. Now, it can be both thrilling and terrifying to think of that. But I want to suggest to you that there's really good news, and that's what we find in the Bible. We find really good news about this. And that is that God offers us a life that we can catch from Him. He offers us a life that we can catch from Him. In other words, we can walk through life with Jesus as our mentor, catching life from Him, a particular kind of life that God offers to us. And so that's the great news. Now, what does this look like? Can we go forward at all? Is it going forward? Okay, then I need a Bible, because I have my scripture written on the slides. Or I could read the. I'm going to look at John chapter 15. This is a biography of Jesus, an ancient biography of Jesus. And he's talking to his people who have walked through life with him for a few years. And it's near the end of his life. And so he's talking to his disciples. And he says, this is John chapter 15. I'm going to start in verse 5. He says, I am the vine, you are the branches. Those who abide in me and I in them bear much fruit, because apart from me you can do nothing. Whoever does not abide in me is thrown away like a branch and withers. Such branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask for whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit and become my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for his friends. If you are my friends, you are my friends if you do what I command. I do not call you servants any longer, because the servant does not know what the master is doing. But I have called you friends, because I have made known to you everything that I have heard from my Father. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, so that the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. I'm giving you these commands so that you may love one another. Great. Okay. First question is, so I've suggested that we can walk through life with Jesus as our mentor, and he uses this word abide in this passage. Other passages, other translations say remain in me or make your home in me. We can walk through life with Jesus and abiding in him. And the question is, what kind of a life is it? If you look just in this passage, there are some phrases in here that suggest this is the kind of life that sort of results if we walk through life with God as our mentor, catching the God life. He says, you will bear much fruit. So the life, theoretically, that Jesus is offering is a life that bears fruit. It's a life that's prosperous. And we can talk about what that means, of course, but at least it means that there's some meaning to it, and there's something that you give away. There's something that grows from your life. He says, ask for what you wish, and it will be acted upon. It's this life of talking with God, of open communication with God, and he actually listens to you. You can walk through life like that. He says, remain in my love. It's a life where we remain in the love of God. We can. He's offering that. He says, I'm telling you this so that your joy may be complete. A total, complete joy. The life he offers us, if we catch this life from him, is a life filled with joy. He says, I call you friends. We can walk through life as friends of God. You will, not only will you bear much fruit, but you will bear fruit that lasts. Your life will have significance beyond you, which I think is what all of us desire, and we're designed for. Your life will have significance beyond you, even beyond your lifespan. He says, this is my command, that you love one another. And so it's couched. Everything that he says, this life of God is a life of love, of receiving the love of God, walking in that love of God every day, and giving it away. And so he offers us this life, this abiding life in him. And so I would just want to suggest three things from this passage. First, he says in verses 5 and 16 later on, he says, I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me, and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Verse 16 says, you did not choose me, but I chose you. Now, he's talking to his disciples, but I think this invitation is for us as well. The first thing to realize is that this life is available. It's possible. And you're invited into it. That's the first thing. It's an invitation into a kind of life. Remember, we're all being shaped by somebody. It's inevitable. We get to choose who we're shaped by. And God offers us to be shaped by him through Christ. Now, this is a legitimate question, who gets to be invited? And Jesus was answering this question all the time when he was walking around on earth 2,000 years ago, because people were always asking him, can I be a part of this thing that you're a part of? Can I know God too, like you? Can I do these things? Who gets to be a part of this? This was a big deal in the first century, especially in Judaism. Who gets to be the people of God? Can you call yourself a person of God? Who gets to? And so Jesus was always answering this question, who gets to be in? And so he told this story. Somebody asked him this, and he told a story. He made up a story to answer the question, who gets to be in? Who gets invited? This is in Luke chapter 14. Jesus said, this is just a story that he made up to answer this question. A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, come, for everything is ready now. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, I have just bought a field, and I must go and see it. Please excuse me. Another said, I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. Still another said, I just got married, so I can't come. The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, go out quickly into the streets and the alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Sir, the servant said, what you ordered has been done, but there is still room. Then the master told his servant, go out to the roads, the country lanes, and compel them to come in so that my house may be full. I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet. The answer simply is, God is eager to compel you to come in. And the only people who don't come to the table are those who believe that there are more important things to do. People aren't excluded by anything that has to do with, you know, social norms or religion or anything. It's nothing about anything like that. There's no exclusion. The exclusion, if there is one, is for people who choose other things as being more important than coming in to this life that God offers. There's a really amazing contemporary version of this parable I want to share with you. It was in the Boston Globe, June of 1990. This account is written by an author named Philip Yancey. He's telling the story about this. He says, accompanied by her fiancé, a woman went to the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Boston and ordered the meal. The two of them pored over the menu, made selections of china and silver, and pointed to pictures of the flower arrangements they liked. They both had expensive taste, and the bill came to $13,000. After leaving a check for half that amount as down payment, the couple went home to flip through books of wedding announcements. The day the announcements were supposed to hit the mailbox, the potential groom got cold feet. I'm just not sure, he said. It's a big commitment. Let's think about this a little longer. When his angry fiancé returned to the Hyatt to cancel the banquet, the events manager could not have been more understanding. The same thing happened to me, honey, she said, and told the story of her own broken engagement. But about the refund, she had bad news. The contract is binding, she said. You're only entitled to $1,300 back. You have two options, to forfeit the rest of the down payment or go ahead with the banquet. I'm really sorry. Really, I am. It seemed crazy, but the more the jilted bride thought about it, the more she liked the idea of going ahead with the party. Not a wedding banquet, mind you, but a big blowout. 10 years before, this same woman had been living in a homeless shelter. She'd got back on her feet, found a good job, and set aside a sizable nest egg. Now, she had the wild notion of using her savings to treat the down and outs of Boston to a night on the town. And so it was that in June of 1990, the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Boston hosted a party such as it had never seen before. The hostess changed the menu to boneless chicken in honor of the groom, she said. Sent the invitations to rescue missions and homeless shelters. That warm summer night, people who are used to peeling half-gnawed pizza off the cardboard dined instead on chicken cordon bleu. Hyatt waiters in tuxedos served hors d'oeuvres to senior citizens propped up by crutches and aluminum walkers. Bag ladies, vagrants, and addicts took one night off from the hard life on the sidewalks outside and instead sipped champagne, ate chocolate wedding cake, and danced to big band melodies late into the night. Jesus is painting a picture of what the welcome of God looks like. Over and over again, he says, you're welcome. You're invited. The invitation is open to you to come into this life that I'm offering. Will you come? And so we have this invitation. The second thing we see is in verses 14 and 15. He says, you are my friends. If you do what I command, I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. And so Jesus invites them in and gives them access. I've made known everything that I've seen my Father doing, I've made known to you. Gives them access. We're invited into a life of accessibility with God, the things of God. He loves to share his life and wants to share it with us. This concept of sharing your life in order to pass it on, this mentoring thought we're thinking about today, was the way it worked in the first century for Jesus and his contemporaries. I want to quote to you a letter that was written in the first century in this book, Signs, Wonders, and the Kingdom of God, written by Don Williams. He's a vineyard pastor, was a vineyard pastor. And he's talking about first century learning, what it looked like. As first century Stoic philosopher Seneca writes to Lucilius, a letter. He says, "Of course, the living voice and the intimacy of a common life will help you more than the written word. You must go to the scene of the action first, because men put more faith in their eyes than in their ears, and second, because the way is long if one follows precepts, but short and helpful if one follows patterns." Cleanthes could not have been the express image of Zeno if he had merely heard his lectures. He shared his life, saw into his hidden purposes, and watched him to see whether he lived according to his own rules. Williams goes on to say, "The same ideal was also dominant in Israel. For the Jews, their rabbis not only were to teach the law, they were to live the law," or live the Bible. "In fact, they were living Torah," is what they were called. For example, he gives a specific example. Rabbi Akiba is his name, a contemporary of the Apostle Paul in the first century, came from a peasant family and only began his studies in his adult years. Later, he reports to his disciples that he even followed his rabbi, Joshua, into the bathroom, where he, quote, "learned from him three good habits." They respond in surprise, wondering if his rabbi wasn't offended by this. And Akiba replies, "I considered everything part of the Torah, and I needed to learn." If that doesn't sound like parenting, I don't know what does. You get followed everywhere. You know, when you have kids, you basically give up privacy. They learn everything, and they learn it by watching. When I was at a point, a really critical point in my journey with God, I was graduating from seminary about 10 years ago, a little bit before I was graduating from seminary, and I was at a critical point in my walk with God. And I was asking God, "What do you want me to do with the next part of my life as I graduate, teaching or ministry or whatever?" Vocationally, I was asking some big questions, but I was also asking some pretty big questions spiritually with regard to how I relate to God. Like, what can I expect of God in my life? What can I expect of God around me? Can I see him work? Can I experience in him? Is that okay? I was asking some pretty big questions, and it was at this point in my life God provided for me a pretty significant mentor. It was actually the man who I just mentioned who wrote this book. His name's Don Williams. Don was the best man in my parents' wedding. And after my father passed away of cancer, my mother called Don, knowing that I was at this critical point in my life, turning point. She called Don and said, "Next time you are in Ohio," I was living in Ohio and Don was living in California, "next time you come to Ohio to visit," which he did on a regular basis, "will you please get together with Chris and just kind of meet with him and talk with him?" And so that started a relationship where every time he would come to Columbus, we would get together and talk about what was going on in my life. And he shared with me his wisdom. And coincidentally, he had walked a very similar path 30 years earlier, asking very similar questions. We, in fact, were a part of the same denomination, had similar backgrounds. And so it was really quite amazing how God had provided this mentor for me. Not only did we meet when he came to Columbus, but he invited me along on some trips. He said, I'm going to be at this conference for a few days. I'm going to teach you a little bit. Other people will be teaching. Why don't you just come and watch? Listen. See how this kind of thing works. And so I went and traveled with him a few places. And I learned, watched him, asked questions, gave me freedom to doubt. Critical point in my life. God provided a life that was accessible to me. Someone who was a little bit further down the path was following God and said, why don't you come? I'll share what I know. Critical point. God gives us access to him. He invites us in. It's open to anyone who accepts the invitation. Third thing. It says in verse 16, I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit. Fruit that will last. So this last part, Jesus says, here is what I've done. I have lived in the love of my Father, and I've modeled that for you. I've invited you to be a part of this life. You're invited to be a part of it. Pour it out for you, and now you go and do likewise. Remain in my love and invite others to be a part of this life. I've appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. At the same time that I was meeting with Don and sort of going through this transformation of the spiritual questioning and this critical point in my life, I invited someone who was a little bit younger than me along on the journey. His name was Josh. He was a college student at the time. And we would get together on a weekly basis at Pizza Hut, of course, Hadid Pizza. And we would get together and talk about these kinds of things, these questions. What can we expect of God? Is God, what can we expect of God in our lives and around us? Who is he? How does he work? Well, we kept meeting, and as time went on, Josh became the worship leader in the church that we ended up planting a few years later. So he grew, became a worship leader, and now is married with two kids and just moved to Nashville to become a teacher. And so he's dedicating his life to giving away what God has given him too. And we've become great friends. He's one of our best friends, one of my best friends. And I think about what God did in me and what I passed on to him, and I think about how satisfying it is to know that that's fruit that's going to last. You know? That what you give away is what lasts. What you pour into others. As you give people access into your life and they're shaped by it, that's the fruit that lasts. Now, this is both thrilling and terrifying, if we're honest. Because there are lots of things that we think maybe this would be good to pass on to others and let them see in me. Maybe help them to be shaped by it. And there are other things and we think, I don't want them to see that. And I certainly don't want them to be shaped by that. I don't want them to deal with the things that I'm dealing with in this area of our lives. Let's be honest. But there has to be some, we can't keep people out. You know? And so let me just suggest, maybe there isn't an easy answer to this. Let me just suggest that there's value in giving people access to you, your strengths and your weaknesses. Not so that your weaknesses can be emulated, but so that what you're doing about your weaknesses could be emulated. I'm wrestling with this in my life. Here's what God is doing in that. Here's how my mentor is helping me through this. emulate the journey, not the weakness. Maybe there's value in that. And so I encourage you to give people access to your life and find people who will give you access to theirs, because it's fruit that will last. So I ask these two questions in the beginning, and I'll finish with these. Whose life am I catching? We get to choose whose life we catch. What kind of life are others catching from me? And I just want to say in closing that we would love for this church to be a church where it's really, really easy to stumble into this kind of a relationship with God. It's really, really easy to stumble into a friendship with people who are pursuing God and to talk through these issues with people. And so we have the home groups that are so accessible. You know, each week, they'll be starting up in a few weeks. And so I just want to finish by saying that's the kind of church that we want to be. If you want to pursue this kind of life, wherever you are on your journey, you can stumble into this kind of relationship with people as they pursue a life with God. And so that's my challenge. Whose life am I catching? And what life are others catching from me? You are invited into a life with God.